The domestic air terminal, Terminal 4, that serves Manila is a far cry from the shining international terminals that welcome travelers to the capital of the Philippines. More like an older bus station, Terminal 4 is crowded and noisy both inside and out. Not exactly the place one would expect to have a life-shifting experience. I had come to Manila to visit with a very trusted vendor with whom my company had been working for over 5 years. And after 3 days of meetings and working with people in the plant, I was off to see a bit of the country. I arrived at the airport by means of a tinted glass Ford Explorer, and I made my way into the terminal and immediately lost my bearings. Too much action. I finally made my way to the ticket counter where I was welcomed and served by 8 smiling and bouncing Filipinos who were eager to write up my boarding pass and my ticket. There wasn't a computer in sight. And send me on my way to the final checkpoint. There, I was directed to a small booth where I was brought up short by a request for a 200 peso departure fee. I am embarrassed to tell you that I arrived at this point with absolutely no Philippine currency in my pocket. So my first question was, how much US? And my second question was, do you take credit cards? When neither question received a favorable answer, my final question was, is there a bank machine in the terminal? And my spirits rose when this question received a brightness in the face across from me, but the answer again was no. However, the woman said, there was a bank with a machine across the road and down from the terminal. Fortunately, I had arrived with plenty of time to spare. Now, this story can follow 2 distinct paths from this point. I have often told the story with self-deprecating humor of my continued ineptitude in obtaining the necessary fee and of my unlikely rescue by the wonderful and colorful Sergeant Nick Perez of the Manila Airport Police, all to procure the equivalent of about $4.50 in Philippine pesos. The story I have told less often is of the moment on this unexpected excursion when I was walking down the airport road and crossing over a waterway that ran close by the end of the runway nearby. Down below the level of the roadway, as far as I could see on either side of the channel, was a squatter's city, an amalgam of tin and wood and fabric, of men and women and children, 1, 2, and sometimes 3 stories high. Like the great wonders of the world, when you see them in film and television, you nod your head and smile. But when you come to them in person, they take your breath away. So too did this experience take my breath away. I had no idea what to do. I didn't have time to stop, and I don't know what I would have done if I had stopped. But in that moment, something inside me shifted. I looked down and saw into the life of things, and I was stunned by the reality. At the very end of the day, when I reached my comfortable hotel and was asked if I wanted somebody to clean my feet as a welcome, I sat at the end of my bed for a long time until the tears came. For who or what was I crying? For myself, yes. To a degree, When our stories are shaken, our personal stories, we lose a bit of ourselves and we grieve. Was I crying for the 2 million squatters in Manila or the billions around the world? Sure. The combination of anger and impotence is a very frustrating thing. But I also began to understand that I was crying for people I knew, people who through some association had become present in my mind, folks back home who I knew were struggling, squatting within what seemed to be a healthy, loving community. My world had shifted. My favorite theologian, Henry Nelson Wyman, calls this qualitative meaning, which he defined as the connections we make between the qualities of something that's happening in the moment and the qualities of many other past events that our memory and our senses bring into that moment. Our stories, our relationships, our experiences, they are all merged into something new, providing us with a new story and a new meaning. And when that meaning is internalized, when we stop and think and accept, we are shifted. And it opens us up to creating an opportunity yet again for new ways to think and to relate. And when we share that story with others, allowing them the same experience, we build on the story, deepening our awareness and appreciation of this world and of each other. Wyman calls this whole process the creative event, and he believed it could be our saving grace. Of course, this takes action on our part, engaging, working, reflecting, sharing, building on what comes out of our shared experience, widening the circle again. The harsh realities of life for so many and the systemic nature of evil to which we all contribute demand our attention. It's only when we begin to work towards solutions that the creative event can take hold and spur us on. And along with action, sharing our stories are an important way that we do this work. For as long as we have existed as a species, there have been stories. Stories that tell of our hardships and our fears, our triumphs and our joys, and all that runs in between. We are, in fact, hardwired for story, thinking always in the narrative form, constantly reflecting and editing and rearranging, communicating, gauging reaction, re-editing, working on this meaning, this personal story that we create and build. Who am I? Why am I here? What do I care about? Stories are the medium that allows us to connect with each other, transcending generations, sharing not only our daily life together, but also the meaning and purpose that we make from it. Stories link us to ancient traditions, legends and archetypes, myths and symbols. And great stories speak to the core of our existence, connecting us to something beyond ourselves, to universal truths. Too often, though, we are in too much of a rush to stop and share. There's a wonderful Sufi teaching story about the Mullah Nasruddin, who was using a rusted axe to cut a large oak. He was working very hard, hardly stopping to take a breath. And a friend was passing by and saw that the mullah was making absolutely no progress at all. At this rate, it seemed like he would be taking years to chop down that mighty tree. He had to work very hard to get the mullah's attention. He was so focused on his task. But when he did, his friend said, "Mullah, why don't you sharpen the axe?" And the mullah panted, "I can't afford the time. I must cut this tree down by tomorrow." We need to stop and take the time to share our stories and then open ourselves up to hearing others. In that creative moment, there is a shared power that is contagious. What is your story? And though you can't know it, through your telling, I guarantee if you tell your story, it will impact the person next to you. Bethany stood up here not long ago and talked about the government shutdown. And she opened up our thought process. Who do you know that is affected by this shutdown? What can you do? We begin to think in broader circles, widening our own sense of self to join in community. This kopiafa that Yosef has given us, this wonderful piece of work with all its symbols, also holds wonderful stories of individuals, people who have worked hard to create a partner church community, people who have traveled back and forth year after year to share their lives and new understandings of what the world is really like. Those are creative events. We grow, we learn. So share your stories. Listen to others tell theirs. You don't know where the next story will come from or where it will take us. We simply need to watch and work and hope together as a community, moving forward, learning, growing, living, loving. I'd like to share with you a wonderful story that I thought of during the preparation for this service. I once saw Naomi Newman tell this story. It's called Repair of the World, Tikkun Olam. It's a Kabbalist creation story, originally written in the Talmud time, but developed upon during the mystical times of the Kabbal movement in the Middle Ages. And Naomi Newman has given it new life. In the beginning, before there were any beginnings or endings, there was no place that was not already God. We call this unimaginable openness Ein Sof, being without end, world without end, Ein Sof. Then came the urge to give life to our world and us. But there was no place that was not already God. So Ein Sof breathed in to make room, like a father steps back so his child will walk to him. We call this withdrawing Tzimtzum. In the emptiness, Ein Sof set vessels and began to fill them with divine light, like a mother places bowls in which to pour her delicious soup. We call these bowls Kalim. As the light poured forth, a perfect world was being created. Think of it. A world without greed and cruelty, without violence. But then something happened. The Kalim shattered. No one knows why. Perhaps the bowls were too frail. Perhaps the light too intense. Perhaps Ein Sof. Perhaps he made a mistake. No one's perfect the first time. With the shattering of the bowls, the divine sparks flew everywhere, some returning to Ein Sof, some falling, trapped in the broken shards to become our world and us. Though it's hard to believe, the perfect world is still all around us, but broken into jagged pieces, like a puzzle thrown to the floor, the picture lost, each piece without meaning until someone puts them back together again. We are that someone. There is no one else. We are the ones who can find the broken pieces and how they fit together and rejoin them. And we call this repair of the world, Tikkun Olam. In every moment, with every act, we can heal our world and us. We are all holy sparks dulled by separation. But when we meet and talk and eat and make love and tell our stories, when we work and play and disagree with holiness in our eyes, seeing Ein Sof everywhere, our brokenness will end. Then our bowls will be strong enough to hold the light, and our light gentle enough to fill the bowls as we repair the world together. And we will learn that there is no place that is not God.